Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this 99% editorial-free edition of Cultural Baggage. I'm headed out to Hartford, Connecticut this weekend to attend a drug conference sponsored by Aetna Insurance. Stay tuned. We'll have several reports from the Drug Truth Network staff, but now our guest, Dr. Stanton Peel. A senior fellow with the Drug Policy Alliance. He's also a professor at the New York University School of Social Work and author of numerous books, including his latest, Seven Tools to Beat Addiction. I'm proud to welcome Dr. Stanton Peel.
It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Dr. Peel, there's a great hysteria about addiction. It circulates around our nation, around the world. Tell us your basic understanding of addiction.
Well, addiction is a tool people develop to try to cope with their lives in the absence of better ways of dealing with stress and the demands that are made on them. It's a sense of inadequacy that translates into a reliance on some external prop to get through life.
And that prop can be gambling addiction, it can be certain types of drugs, legal or illegal. Let's look at the situation regarding methamphetamine. That seems to be the hot topic these days. Tell us your understanding. Is it a hopeless situation?
I agree with you in your description of the different kinds of addictions that people can have, like gambling, like shopping, like eating, and that's one of the things that has emerged in our understanding around the world of addiction, that addiction can take many different forms. And one of the things that teaches us is that we need to not be alarmed by one addiction versus another, because any addiction has certain downsides that makes it an addiction, because it's a way of trying to deal with life that ultimately is harmful to you. But on the other hand, one addiction or one type of drug rises to the fore and people become very alarmed about it. But in general, addictions tend to resemble each other in terms of how bad they are and in terms of people's ability to overcome them.
And insofar as that, again, the hot ticket per the Drug Enforcement Administration these days, methamphetamine, it's no more addicting than other drugs, is it? I mean, they say it's impossible to break the habit, but that's not true, is it?
They've said that about a lot of different things. You know, Alan Leshner, the former head of the NIDA, said it's not true that millions of people go around breaking addictions on their own, but we know that's true because the most single addictive drug in the United States that's used by the most people, it's a stimulant. Methamphetamines are stimulants, and they're easy to obtain. They're legal, and that substance is tobacco and nicotine. But 50 million people have quit smoking. It's a lot of people. It's about half of all the people who've ever been addicted to cigarettes. And here's something I'll tell your listeners that may amaze them. A higher percentage of people quit addictions to methamphetamines than quit smoking.
The government mantra seems to be shifting from incarceration to one of forced treatment. Is that going to be a better solution?
It's an interesting shift. In a way, people who are trying to reform American drug policies in general are encouraging treatment instead of prison. But when you ask the question, what does it mean to tell people, we're going to put you in jail or you should be treated, or maybe we'll just put you in jail and treat you, you get a real kind of fogginess between those two things. For example, it seems to be quite important in people's success at treatment that they choose treatment and that the treatment they choose they feel comfortable with or that it reflects their values. For example, some people do well in AA or 12-step groups. Other people don't like them because they're atheists, because they don't like to say, maybe they're a feminist and they don't like to say, I'm powerless. So what seems to really work best for people is that they select a treatment showing that they want to make the change and that they own the treatment and that they're invested in the treatment. So I'm a little bit skeptical and worried about the fact that so much treatment now is coercive and it's forced on people against their wills. I don't predict good outcomes from that. And in a way, it's in some ways it's a worse violation of civil liberties than just going to prison, because when you go to prison they take your time away from you and your freedom, but when you force treatment on people, sometimes that involves forcing concepts on them that they may not accept or that may be wrong or dangerous. For example, to tell people, well, in order to get better from treatment, you have to accept that you'll always be an addict or an alcoholic. That works for some people, but other people don't find that helpful. And in fact, it's not true. Many people overcome those problems. And to force them to acknowledge that or to believe that is very insidious.
Well, in your book, Seven Tools to Beat Addiction, there is a chapter there about identifying one's own strengths and weaknesses, because what I'm hearing is that there is a different means of accomplishing this from person to person, situation to situation.
Well, right. There's a couple of... My book, Seven Tools to Beat Addiction, talks about the resources that you have in life that you can bring to bear on your addiction. And a lot of us have different strengths and abilities that we make use of. For example, what if you want to quit a drinking or a drug and you've already quit smoking? One resource you already have is that you know how to quit an addiction. You've already done it. So instead of going someplace and them saying, this is how you quit an addiction, my approach would be to say, well, let's think about how you quit smoking. How did you go about doing that? Maybe that'll give us some real pointers for something else you want to quit. There is another chapter in the book, by the way, another tool called Your Identity. Quitting an addiction involves, in important ways, how you think about yourself, including maturing. People get to be more mature and to think outside of themselves, to think about other people, to think about the community around them. And when that happens, people are able to leave behind addictions almost as though they were very immature behaviors. For example, most people are going to think a lot differently about taking drugs or smoking marijuana or taking methamphetamines when they have their own children compared to when they were teenagers or young adults on their own. It just sharpens your focus and you realize that other people are counting on you. And that's one example of how people are able to make use of their life experience to overcome their addictions. And it's more important what happens to you in life than any treatment you receive.
Well, I think much of the roadblocks set in place to stop some people from breaking an addiction have to do with the hysteria, the propaganda that's been put forth that it's going to be hell on earth, shaking uncontrollably for days, sweats and fevers and so forth. But oftentimes by facing down the lions, we find that it's not nearly so bad.
Right. I don't know how you would know that, but I often hear people say those things. And one way or another, you're going to have to get over... Well, for example, if you quit smoking, there's got to be a period of discomfort. And if you're not prepared to deal with that period of discomfort, you know, you've got to sort of brace yourself and realize, you know, it's going to take some doing and overcoming some unpleasantness. Although that actually only lasts, really only a matter of days. And then after that, you've got to avoid the issue of relapse. But you're so right that in the United States we overemphasize the danger, the strength of an addiction. We're so, it's almost perverted the way we do that. For example, at one point there was an ad saying trying to beat an addiction on your own is like trying to remove your own appendix. And you sort of imagine that maybe the addiction treatment providers in the United States put out that ad. Let me just give you another example. We know 95% of those people who quit smoking, they did it on their own. And if you go around and ask people, you know, you do your own addiction research, you'll find that virtually all the people you'll find who quit smoking did so without professional help. And the same remarkably is true with alcohol and with drugs. Now, in Switzerland, they recognize that there are many, they have heroin addicts there, and they have, of course, like the United States, many more smokers than they have heroin addicts. They also recognize that for one reason or another, most people aren't going to end up in treatment. They just don't want to identify themselves as an addict or whatever. So they said, let's make use of the fact that so many people quit addictions on their own to educate people that even if they don't go to treatment, they can quit smoking or quit a heroin habit. It can happen. They can do it. And so they took out billboards contesting the idea that addiction was a lifetime disease. That's so funny, isn't it? In the United States, we try to convince people addiction is a lifetime disease. Why would we do such a perverse thing? It's hard to fathom. Whereas in Europe, in this case in Switzerland, they're trying to emphasize to you that you have strength on your own. They're trying to tell you, look, you can overcome an addiction. Millions of people have done it. Many people have done it. Try it on your own if you're not prepared to go into treatment. We believe you can do it.
And that is the point, that the individual should not succumb to the myths. They do have a lot of capability, a lot of strengths built in.
They do have those strengths. Seven Tools to Beat Addiction is looking through your life for the tools, the strengths you already have, the friends and neighbors you have, the activities that are a part of your life that you can use as a way of overcoming addiction. There's a term in psychology called self-efficacy. The more you believe in your power to help yourself, the more better able you are to look around you and to gather up, you know, the resources needed to do something, the better off you're going to be. That's what psychological health is about, and that's what quitting addictions is about.
Well, Dr. Stanton Peel, I was just looking at your website, and I see you do on occasion answer questions from patients or people with problems.
I also do internet and phone telephone coaching and consulting for people, because I found that you can accomplish actually quite a bit, even at a distance.
Yes, sir. And that website?
www.peele.net. Peele spelled P-E-E-L-E.
There's another wave of hysteria. It's a part of an ongoing cycle, I suppose. But the pain doctors are being set up by the DEA for prescribing pills to people with pain. Being called drug pushers. Your thoughts on that, sir?
Well, America's a society preoccupied with addiction, and it's sort of almost, if you're worried about addiction, then you're frightened of treating pain. For example, that's been a big issue in American hospitals, inadequate pain relief. But in general, people who are seeking relief from pain, you know, particularly when it's post-operative pain or acute pain due to a particular problem, are not inclined to become addicted. Most people know that they're using an analgesic to remedy a particular problem they have, and they're not going out of their way, you know, to, you know, like Rush Limbaugh, to illegally obtain medications to continue that habit. You know, I receive a lot of email about is people who feel that they become addicted to medications, and they ask me what to do. Of course, I'm at a loss in many cases to try and deal with that, because in many cases they've been dealing with a particular physician, and you need to be alert to that and deal with that with your physician from the word go. But on the other hand, when you're really addressing issues of pain and personal pain, you can't be so frightened by the possibility that some people become addicted, that you under-medicate yourself, it'll lead to more problems, medical and addictive, than being properly prescribed the appropriate amount of medication.
Well, Dr. Peel, any other hot buttons you'd like to talk about?
I'll reiterate what you talk about. Methamphetamines, it's as though, well, this is a new drug. It's not like any other drug we've ever seen. We'll never be able to deal with it. It's really, remember crack cocaine? That came and it went in many cases. You've pointed out that in the United States, the movement towards coercive treatment has really become a major issue. And we've also pointed out that addiction can take place to a wide variety of objects. I guess if there's one other hot button I'd like to point out is, we medicate children with quite powerful drugs from earlier and earlier ages in the United States now. I'm currently writing a book addressed to parents about addiction issues with children. You've got to, instead of worrying about adults having too much pain medication, we probably would do better worrying about adolescents who are taking, you know, Ritalin and other drugs for ADHD, and teenagers, sometimes quite young adolescents, taking antidepressant drugs. The consequences of those drugs, for not only for the young person, but how they'll affect people's development. What's it mean if you're 15 years old and you're convinced that you have ADHD and that you need to rely on Ritalin to survive into adulthood? What's that mean for a person? You come to see yourself as being dependent on a drug and that you can't function without it. That has a lot to do with addiction, and we need to be much more aware of addiction at early ages now, particularly through the drugs that we actually, the medical providers, actually give to young people.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Unexplained rapid weight gain, trouble breathing, unusual fatigue, fast pounding heartbeat, changes in menstrual cycles, dark urine, persistent nausea, vomiting, chills, cold sweat, dizziness, drowsiness, shaking, and confusion, and fruity breath odor.
Time's up. The answer, Avandia for diabetics. Approved by the FDA.
This is Phil Smith with this week's Corrupt Cop Story for the Drug Truth Network. This week we're going to Whitpain, Pennsylvania, where an investigation into drugs missing from the township police department's evidence room has concluded without any charges being filed, according to a report in the Philadelphia Reporter last week. According to Montgomery County District Attorney Bruce Castor, former police detective Sergeant William Bunting was named by other law enforcement officers as the probable culprit, but Castor couldn't make the case. "We were asked by the chief to investigate narcotics that went missing from the evidence room," Castor said, "but we were unable to determine how the drugs became missing," end quote. That was because department policy allowed too many people access to the evidence room, he said. "We couldn't determine with sufficient particularity who we thought was stealing the drugs," he said, adding that he had written a letter to the department urging it to, quote, drastically tighten up its policies. Chief Joseph Stemple said that he has now done that. As always, there are more corrupt cop stories. Check them out online at the Drug War Chronicle at www.stopthedrugwar.org.
Almost every week, Phil Smith brings us these corrupt cop stories, but he was also this week's guest on the Century of Lies program, reporting on his recent trip to Kabul, Afghanistan. If you'd like to hear that full interview, please go to drugtruth.net and click on the latest link for Century of Lies. And here's the 1% editorial. We offer a $1,200 reward to any drug warrior willing to come on the show and spend 20 minutes explaining the need for eternal drug war. And of course they cannot, because they are cowards.
All right, enough is enough. For far too long, drug legalization advocates have snickered and sneered at the opposition to the local supermarket selling crank and smack and vanilla and cherry flavors. Their claim being that there need be no debate, because both the people and the facts are on their side. This position strikes me as particularly odd, seeing as neither the people nor the facts support drug legalization. Let's start with the people. There is absolutely no evidence that the majority of people support the legalization of hardcore narcotics. None. In fact, what we have been able to gather shows the exact opposite. Recent polls show that 82% of Americans oppose the legalization of hardcore narcotics. So the people do not want their fellow citizens doing coke off a knife in the gas station bathroom. So what about the facts? Drug legalization advocates say things like, not all crack and heroin users are addicts. Marijuana rebuilds brain cells. There's no such thing as a crack baby, and crystal meth is not the danger that we all know it to be. Do these sound like facts to you? I'll tell you this much. Somebody is lying to you. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
The FBI issued its 2004 Uniform Crime Report this week. Like other federal agencies, the FBI tries its best to spin the figures in the most favorable way. According to the new UCR, from 2003 to 2004, the estimated volume of violent crime in the nation declined 1.2%, and the estimated volume of property crime declined 1.1%. Yet these are only reported crimes. The real number of crimes committed in 2004 is much higher. The Bureau of Justice Statistics reported in September 2005 that in 2004, U.S. residents age 12 or older experienced an estimated 24 million violent and property victimizations. These criminal victimizations included an estimated 18.6 million property crimes, 5.2 million violent crimes, and 224,000 personal thefts. Murder victims can't respond to surveys, so murders are excluded from that count. During 2004, 50% of all violent victimizations and 39% of all property crimes are estimated to have been reported to the police. The FBI also tried to respond to and mollify complaints that drug enforcement and juvenile justice authorities focused too harshly on communities of color. Thus, they reported that in 1994, 60.6% of juveniles arrested for drug abuse violations were white. However, by 2003, that number had risen to 74.9%. Yet, these figures are badly misleading. The UCR program has long been criticized for failing to give account of people of Hispanic, Latin American ethnicity. Many of these so-called white juveniles are in fact Hispanic. Until a more accurate measure is mandatory, this obfuscation will continue. Clearance rates most clearly point out the failure of current law enforcement policies. A law enforcement agency reports that an offense is cleared by arrest when at least one person is arrested, charged with commission of an offense, and turned over to court for prosecution. The UCR for 2004 reports that in 2004, law enforcement agencies in the United States cleared 46.3% of violent crimes, that's murder, forcible rape, robbery, and aggravated assault, and only 16.5% of property crimes, things like burglary, larceny theft, and motor vehicle theft. That is, again, those crimes which have been brought to law enforcement's attention. Finally, arrest figures reveal just how badly misplaced law enforcement priorities really are. There were more than 14 million arrests in the U.S. in 2004, of which 590,000 were for all violent crimes combined, and 1.6 million were for all property crimes. There were more than 1.7 million drug arrests, nearly 700,000 of which were only for marijuana possession. Remember these numbers next time someone you know is mugged or your home is broken into. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
This is Loretta Nall reporting live from the campaign trail in Alabama. It's been a very exciting week for me here on the campaign trail. The Associated Press did an excellent interview and profile of me that hit all major and minor Alabama newspapers over the weekend. This is historical because the AP rarely covers third-party candidates, and never have they given coverage to a third-party candidate in Alabama this early on in the race. At 6:30 Monday night, I was a guest on the Lee Davis Show out of Birmingham. The Lee Davis Show is a Christian conservative, pro-Bush, loves Ann Coulter, you get the picture. However, the show went over very well, and the host only brushed on the topic of drug policy reform and focused instead on my other platform planks, as many conservatives are interested in what I have to say. So something very odd and somewhat unexpected is happening in Alabama as a result of my campaign. There are evangelical Christians posting support for me on my blog. There are black business owners in Montgomery helping to gather signatures for me. There are Republican and Democratic diehards who are sending money and signing petitions because they want their candidate to know that this is a very serious issue, but they're too afraid to speak up for their own safety. They want me on the ballot and in the debates even if they do not plan to vote for me. A major conservative talk shows here are paying serious attention to my platform. The Birmingham News stole my Out Jesus line and used it in the op-ed that appeared on Sunday, and there's been zero backlash about the fact that I'm a declared atheist. I'm even getting emails and phone calls from people who say they've never voted but are going to register and vote for me because they feel that I truly represent them. All of this is happening live and on the air for Alabamians to hear. The opposition is extremely nervous about all of this. My sincerest thanks to all of you who have made campaign contributions. I believe I've tapped into a serious voter backlash here in Alabama, where 42% of us who are eligible to vote do not do so in any given election. In a three-way race, 42% wins the prize. I have what it takes to win this election in strength, determination, and perseverance. Please help me make it happen at nallforgovernor.com. This is Loretta Nall, candidate for governor of Alabama. Until next time, y'all skip that quarter bag and help me buy a little bit of freedom down south.
Loretta Nall, running for governor of Alabama. You've heard the phrase, don't criticize the media, become the media. She's taken that to another level. Rather than criticize the politicians, she has become a politician. As head of the U.S. Marijuana Party, Loretta is making great strides in opening the discussion about the drug war.
Coming up October 21st and 22nd, there will be a landmark conference sponsored by Aetna Insurance, presented by the City of Hartford, and hosted by Trinity College. The point of the drug policy conference is to bring law enforcement groups, state agencies, state and city representatives, and national experts with creative talent to meet the drug war scourge head on. The aim of the conference is to challenge these experts to tell us what resources are needed to increase success rates in efforts to reduce drug use and its associated social and criminal ramifications. We are looking for an audience of city policymakers, state agency representatives, legislators, caregivers from a wide range of social services, such as the medical providers, the representatives of problem-solving committees, and neighborhood organizations, which include church members and city residents. The goal of the conference is to provide up-to-the-minute information, which would lead to the next steps and conclusions and discussions and community of activists for possible policy changes that will make a real difference in people's lives. This is Cliff Thornton for the Drug Truth Network.
If you'd like to learn more about this conference before or after, please visit Cliff's website, efficacy-online.org. So now I'm headed to Hartford, Connecticut to report on that drug conference, and the following week I'll report from San Francisco on the wonders of cannabis. The promoter, Ed Rosenthal, the guru of ganja.
Ed, I'm proud of the fact that you've invited me to participate in this year's Wonders of Cannabis.
The Wonders of Cannabis Festival is a fair that we're having in the County Fair Building of San Francisco, October 29th and 30th, features many speakers including Tommy Chong, Rick Steves, Tony Serra, myself, Jack Herra. It's going to be a really festive occasion, and it's going to celebrate all cannabis in all of its aspects. And we're going to have videos and films, hands-on demonstrations. We have legal seminars, medical seminars, and we're looking at it not only in its recreational and medical aspects, but also in its industrial and fashion aspects as well, and food too. It's just such a wonderful plant that it deserves its own celebration.
And again, that's Halloween weekend in San Francisco. All right, that's about it. I urge you to please contact your politicians, help bring this drug war to an end. Visit our website, endprohibition.org. It's really up to you. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Tap dancing on the edge of an abyss.